Okay, now it's working. Okay, folks. Sorry, I forgot to send you the start of the class test, so might as well look at it now, and it's a pretty simple test. Today we're going to talk about two things. One is we're going to complete our discussion of risk-free rates, okay? And we're going to kind of nail down why risk-free rates vary across currencies and why it's okay to value a company in any currency. We're also going to start a discussion of the equity risk premium. So let's start. Thank you. Let's start with the risk-free rate question. I have a very simple problem to pose to you. I'm valuing a Brazilian company. You can pick the company, Embraer, Ambev, you know. I'm valuing a Brazilian company, and I have a choice of either valuing it in nominal Brazilian reais or in U.S. dollars. You think you can't value a Brazilian company in U.S. dollars? That's who? You can pick a company and value it in any currency you want. I have a choice of valuing it either in dollars or in reais. My question is, I know we haven't talked about cash flows and coming up with discount rates. Just an intuitive question. I come up with a value for the company using both approaches. Which of these two currencies am I going to get the higher value in? Will it be in U.S. dollars? Because the risk-free rate in U.S. dollars is only 2.5%. The risk-free rate in reais is 7.5%. So using a lower risk-free rate will give me a lower discount rate, which will give me a higher value, right? Or will it be in reais, perhaps because I have to convert everything into reais and the exchange rate is going to work in my favor because, you know, I'm going from dollars to reais? Or should it not matter? Just give me a gut. What would you like the answer to be? Which would make your life easiest? If it doesn't matter, right? Why? Because then you can pick any company and value it in any currency, you should get the same value. And here's the other reason you'd like it to not matter. Can you imagine again valuing a company in dollars and telling me it's cheap and then valuing the same company in reais and telling me it's expensive? It sounds mysterious. How can the value be the same if the risk-free rates are so different? Today we're going to crack what I call the currency code. Once you get this, from this point on, you'll never have trouble with currencies. It's kind of a magical promise, but let's see if I can deliver. Could I do everything in real terms? What's different there? I'm going to take inflation out of my cash flows. I'm going to take inflation out of my discount rate. I'm going to use a real discount rate. There again, if you do it right, and I'll answer the question for you, you should get the same value if you value a company in real terms or in nominal terms. And again, it sounds mysterious. How can you get the same value if your risk-free rate in real terms is 1% or 0.5% and in nominal terms is 2.5% or 7.5%? Again, the answer is going to turn out to be much simpler than it looks from the outside. So we'll come back and talk about what causes risk-free rates to vary across currencies. In the process, you're going to see why currencies don't matter. Now, let's take another issue that I think has befuddled analysts for the last 10 years in the U.S. We know how we talked about the T-bond rate being the risk-free rate in U.S. dollars, right? And what's that number look like right now? It's a really low number, 2.5%. It's been as low as 1.8%. And in fact, for much of the last 10 years, the T-bond rate has been much lower than historical. The average T-bond rate over time is about 5%. We're at 2.5%, and it's been like that for the last 10 years. And if you ask most people, most investors, most analysts, most portfolio managers, why this is, their answer will be because the Fed has kept rates low. So I just want your insight. Again, I'm not looking for a right or wrong answer. I just want to see what your priors are. Do you think that's true or false? Do you think the Fed is what's kept rates low for the last 10 years? Again, don't look for the right answer. Just think about what your current... So as I said, you don't have to tell me. Think about what the answer is. Today we're going to come back and ask, is that true? Because today is actually the Federal Open Market Committee meeting. All of Wall Street will be waiting with bated breath to see what Janet Yellen is going to let out of smoke out of the chimney. It's like the Pope being, you know, rates go up, rates go down. But that might not be a bad idea for the Federal Open Market Committee. Have a chimney, release gray smoke if rates are going to go up, blue smoke if it's not going up. But again, the notion is what the Fed does today is going to have a profound impact. So let's say, I think the meeting ends at 1:30, the Federal Open Market Committee decides to raise rates. Big news, right? You're going to see that, you know, headline for Bloomberg, CNBC, Wall Street Journal. Does that mean the T-bond rate is going to be higher tomorrow? Again, true or false? What do you think will happen? So if the Fed decides to raise rates today, tomorrow when you do your valuation, is the T-bond rate you're going to see going to be higher than today? Again, we're going to see the answer to the question, but again, I'm not looking for a right or a wrong answer. I want you to think about what you believe about rates right now, because let's start from there. Which brings me to my third and final question. I'm going to show you risk-free rates in many currencies today. In fact, every currency I can compute in. And for the last 2 years, there have been at least three, perhaps more currencies, maybe four currencies, where the risk-free rate is a negative number. It's actually a little mind-boggling when you think about it. Because usually when you lend money, you get paid, right? With negative risk-free rates, what happens? When you lend money, they pay you. In fact, there are Danish homeowners who take mortgages where the bank mails them a check every month. It's against the normal. You don't think of that as though, in fact, every econ class, you have a lending rate. You have an interest rate that you charge, and this seems to violate every single thing we've learned in economics. And that freaks people out. So if I ask you to value a company in Swiss francs, right now the risk-free rate in Swiss francs is minus 0.5%. And there are people who actually argue that because rates are negative, and that's unnatural, you cannot do traditional discounted cash flow evaluation and come up with discount rates because you're building off a base that's negative. Again, I want to think, is that true? Because there are people who have actually stopped doing discounted cash flow evaluation because rates are negative. And in fact, you know what they often do? They take that rate that they don't like because it's unnatural and replace it with a rate that they think is more natural. They call it a normalized rate. God only knows where they pull the number from. But they say, oh, minus 0.5%, I can't work with 2%, I can. So I'm going to replace the minus 0.5. So we're going to talk about the process of normalizing rates. So this wasn't really a test because I kind of threw out these open questions. I wanted to think about it because I really want you to be clear about what you think right now about interest rates and who sets them. And then we'll talk about what the reality is for many of these numbers. So let's open up to the lecture notes to page 33, which is where I left you in the last session, where you had government bond rates in about 40 currencies. So I pulled up the government bond rates, and I sent you the link from which I pulled these numbers off. So if you're interested in getting updated values, you can go visit that site. These are local currency government bond rates. Again, I want to emphasize that. These are local currency government bond rates. So these are the rates that the government is borrowing in its local currency. The Brazilian rate that you see there is a nominal real government bond rate. The ZEC rate that you see there is a ZEC Corona rate. So basically, it's in the local currency. So you can see the rates are different across much of the world. Already, you can see your problem areas, right? There's the Swiss franc, minus 0.19%. Let's come back to that later. Let's focus in on one country. Let's pick Brazil. Why not? The Brazilian 10-year government bond rate on January 1st, or the end of December, December 31st, January 1st of 2017, was 11.37%. Everybody with that? That's a government bond rate I'm taking from the market. Let's say I have to do a valuation in Brazilian reais. I want a risk-free rate in Brazilian reais, right? I cannot use the 11.37% as my risk-free rate. Why? Because the Brazilian government is not default-free. So my task is laid out for me. If I can somehow extract from that 11.37%, whatever is due to default risk, I can end up with a risk-free rate in reais. I'm going to give you three different ways in which you can get the number. You're going to be overwhelmed and say, why three? Why can't you just give us one? Because for some countries, only one of the three will work. You might as well be familiar with all three. With Brazil, all three will work, which will leave us with an embarrassment of riches because I'm going to get three different default spreads for Brazil. Here's the first one. I went and found a Brazilian dollar-denominated bond, and this is from the FT Everyday reported, which, you know, a dollar-denominated bond that matures in January 2018. That dollar-denominated bond rate was 4.86%. Hang in there with me. That's the rate on a Brazilian dollar-denominated bond. A UST bond with exactly the same maturity had a 1.22% rate. So I have two rates, right? They're both in bond. They're both in U.S. dollars. One is the UST bond rate, 1.22%. One is the Brazilian rate. Remember, these are both in dollars, so I can compare them. The difference between those two which is 3.64%, is a measure of the default spread for Brazil, because that's how much I'm charging to buy the Brazilian dollar-denominated bond. This will not work if I compare a local currency bond to a dollar bond, but if I have $2 bonds, which I can for much of Latin America, I can come up with a default spread by comparing the rate on the 10-year or the 5-year or the 3-year bond with the equivalent T-bond. That's the first way to get default spread. So the first approach gives me a default spread for Brazil of 3.64%. Any questions? Let's move to the second. This is a relatively recent market. It's called the... Do you have a question? No. This is called the sovereign CDS market, the credit swap market. You're saying, what the heck is it? This is a market you can go to buy insurance against default risk. So the way it works is, if I bought that Brazilian bond with 11.37% rate, and I was worried that the Brazilian government would default on me, I can go to the CDS market and buy insurance. And the way the insurance works is, when I get that 11.34% from Brazil, or whatever the rate was, I'd have to pay this as insurance each year, because that's what insurance costs me. January 2017, the Brazilian 10-year bond rate, 10-year CDS rate, was 3.59%. So based on the sovereign CDS market, I'd have to pay a default spread of 3.59% for Brazil. This market has an advantage and a disadvantage. It's an advantage because it reflects what's going on in the market right now. That number, 3.59% in Brazil, was 5.5% a year ago. What was different a year ago? Political risk in Brazil was boiling over a year ago. It's kind of simmered down a little bit, but it was 1.3% 5 years ago. So the market changes its mind in countries depending on what's happening in the country. So it's a much more timely number. The downside, though, it's a much more volatile number. Markets sometimes overreact in either direction. One of the things about the sovereign CDS market is it is not a pure insurance market. It's not a pure insurance market because there's what's called counterparty risk. You know what counterparty risk is? When you buy insurance, you think you're going to be insured, right? But that's true only if the person selling you the insurance is around to pay the insurance. So in many markets, that's backed up. There's a central clearinghouse that makes sure you get the insurance if you buy it. In this market, there is no such clearinghouse. So that 3.59% is not a pure price for insurance, because some of it might be for counterparty risk. So here's a way I'm going to try to clean up for it. It's a little bit of cheating, but I'm going to do it anyway. I'm going to assume that there are a couple of countries in this list who have no default risk. I'm going to take the U.S., for instance, which has a 0.38% CDS spread, and say, you know what, there's no default risk. The reason there's a CDS spread then is because of the counterparty risk. In fact, what that 0.38% becomes is my measure of the counterparty risk, subtracting that 0.38% from the 3.59% gives me a second measure of default risk for Brazil of 3.21%. Did everybody get where the 3.21 came from? Take the 3.59 for Brazil, subtract out the U.S., and you're subtracting out the U.S. because you're saying that's what the counterparty risk is creating in my spread. So now I have two numbers for Brazil, 3.64% from the dollar bond, 3.21% from the sovereign CDS market. There's a third stop I can make. Brazil has a sovereign rating. Moody's assigns one, S&P assigns one. Brazil's sovereign rating in January 2017 was Ba2. So you can see where it falls, right? AAA is a country that Moody says has no sovereign risk, all the way down to D, country in default. So Venezuela is going to be way down at the bottom. Switzerland is going to be way up at the top. Brazil falls right in the middle, Ba2. This is a lookup table that I update at the start of every year, where if you tell me the sovereign rating for a country, I'll go look up in this table what a typical default spread is. You're saying, if you have the first two numbers, why would you waste your time on this? If I had the first two numbers, I don't need this table. You know when I need this table? Is if you give me Ghana, and you say, what's the risk-free rate in Ghana? There is no sovereign CDS spread for Ghana. There is no dollar-denominated bond in Ghana, but there is a rating for Ghana, and I can tell you this is the default spread. So there are many countries where this is the only way I can get a default spread for the country. And based on this approach, I'm getting 3.47%. I got incredibly lucky. You know why? Because all three approaches are giving me numbers that are roughly around the same, 3.64, 3.21, 3. Don't expect that to always be the case. So let's talk about what happens next. What is this default spread for? To clean up my government bond rate, right? So I'll take all three approaches and show you what my risk-free rate in reais will be with each approach. So what I did was I started with 11.37% government bond rate in reais, which I accepted was not risk-free. With the first approach, my default spread is 3.64%. When I subtract out 3.64% from 11.37, my risk-free rate in reais is 7.73%. The second approach, where I get the 3.21% spread net of the US CDS, if I use that as my measure of default spread, my risk-free rate in reais is 8.16%. With the third approach, where my default spread is 3.47% based on the rating, my risk-free rate is 7.90%. You say, which one should I use? I'm going to say something very strange. Pick one and stay consistent. Because I'm going to come back a little later in this game and ask you to estimate risk premiums for Brazil. And whatever you used as your measure of default spread here, I want you to stick with that later. And if you're consistent, the numbers are all going to gel out. So don't waste your time saying, which is the best approach? There is no best approach. There are the three different slices or three different ways of estimating default risk. Pick one to clean up your risk rating. So that's the process that I go through at the start of every year. And I do it twice every year to come up with risk-free rates in different currencies. And in the middle of the year, I have to value a company, and I have to do it in a currency where there is nothing that is default-free. I always have to go through this process. I don't know whether any of you remember, but in September of 2011, actually the summer of 2011, there was a brief period where S&P actually lowered the ratings for the U.S. from AAA. And there was a worry that Moody's would follow. Let's assume the rating for the U.S. goes from AAA to AA. What would you need to do to get a risk-free rate in U.S. dollars then? You'd have to start with the T-bond rate. And you'd have to do what I did for Brazil, right? You've got to net out whatever the default spread for a AA-rated bond is. Your risk-free rate then would no longer be the T-bond rate. You're saying, that's a nightmare. Get used to it, because we're getting closer and closer to a world where we could argue that nothing might be risk-free sooner or later, in which case you'll have to do this for every currency. So this is not going to be just for emerging market currencies. This is a process you can use for any currency. I'll give you an example. 3 years ago with the British pound, if you asked me what the risk-free rate was, I'd have given you the UK government gilt rate. Today, I can no longer do that. What's changed? 3 years ago, the UK was a AAA-rated country. Today, it's a AA-rated country. With the U.S., the reason I stick with the T-bond rate is at least Moody's has stayed with the AAA rating. I might be grasping at straws to make my life easier, but I'm ready. If the rating drops, I know what I need to do. It's not rocket science. It just is a little more layer, one more layer to add to my estimation process. Any questions on the risk-free rate? Yes. Why don't you just average the three? I try to repeat your questions because when people build these classrooms, the architects who build these classrooms, they always think about one way. You know? They think about, can you hear what I'm saying? They never think about, can you hear what each other is saying? And no, that. So the question was, why, you could. In which case, when you get to the equity risk premium stage, use the same average. Okay? Averaging gives you a false sense of comfort. That's a reality, right? So it makes you feel more comfortable. Ultimately, it's a false comfort. I'd rather pick one if I trust it more than the other. If I don't, I would average out. So average if you feel they're all fuzzy numbers. But if one is better, just stay with it. No other questions? Okay. Now let's talk about getting a real risk-free rate. Real risk-free rate you would use if your cash flows are real cash flows. What does that mean? When I project my revenues and my cash flows, I'm going to act like I can't increase prices, that there is no inflation in the environment. That's what real cash flows are. So if I'm discounting real cash flows, I need a real risk-free rate. Last session, I talked about TIPS, the inflation-protected treasury bond rate. You know how TIPS rates work? Right now, for instance, you buy a TIPS bond, the rate is 0.5%. So you hold the bond at the end of the year. What are you going to get as your coupon? How does a TIPS bond work? Nobody's any idea? Does anybody actually own a TIPS bond? Here's what will happen. Let's say next year the inflation rate is 2%. Your coupon will be 0.5% plus 2%. So you get 2.5% as a coupon. The year after that, let's say the inflation goes to 5%. You will get 0.5% plus 5%, you will get 5.5%. The year after that, you have deflation of minus 0.5%. You get no coupon at all. You think that's so unfair. Hey, you get the upside, you get the downside. With a TIPS rate, you're guaranteed 0.5% real rate of return no matter what happens. Your actual rate of return will obviously vary depending on what inflation does. The TIPS rate is a real rate. And I'm going to argue it's a real risk-free rate, and I'm going to make a leap of faith here. I'm going to take that 0.5% and use that as my real risk-free rate in Brazil, in Germany, in Japan. You're saying, you can't do that. It's a U.S. real risk-free rate. Think about Econ 101. Real risk-free rates, if you have no barriers to capital, should be the same in every country. Why? Let's say you have a real risk-free rate of 0.5% in the U.S. and 3% in Germany. What's going to happen? Capital is going to leave the U.S. and go to Germany till the rates. It's an assumption because obviously capital doesn't move freely across borders. So to the extent that capital doesn't, you could say this is a reach, I agree. But until we can come up with a better way of getting real risk-free rates, if you ask me for a real risk-free rate, I'm going to ask you to go look up the TIPS rate and use that as your real risk-free rate no matter where the company is in the world. But the assumption you're making is capital can move freely across markets. So now let's talk about what to do in general if you don't have a default-free entity. I've kind of laid out, at least the first approach, what you do is you start with a government bond rate, like I did for Brazil, and you back out the default spread to come up with a riskless rate in the local currency. That's your first choice. The second is you can do your analysis in real terms and avoid the issue of what's the risk-free rate. The third is you can give up on the local currency and do your analysis in a different currency. Two years ago, I was in Moscow, and I had to value a Russian company. And initially, I was going to value it in rubles. And after about 2 hours of wrestling with the ruble risk-free rate, I said, why am I doing this stupid thing? I'm just going to value it in U.S. dollars. And if I do it right, I get the same value anyway. So there are currencies where I'm not even going to wrestle with the local currency because I give up. You ask me to value a Venezuelan company. Do you want to estimate a risk-free rate in Venezuelan Bolivar? Are you crazy? Inflation rate was, 15,000% last year? What's your risk-free rate going to be, 15,323%? Try putting that in your Excel spreadsheet using the present value function. See things blow up on the spreadsheet. I don't want to go there. So reserve for yourself the option of if you cannot find a risk-free rate in the local currency, that you can do your valuation in another currency. If you really, really insist on getting a risk-free rate, I'm going to give you a shortcut that works really well for me, and you're welcome to use it or not use it. I don't know whether you remember one of the first building blocks when you talk about interest rates, and I mentioned this last time, is the Fisher equation. Anybody remember the Fisher equation? That the risk-free rate in a currency is expected inflation plus an expected real interest rates. It's like Econ 101. If I can estimate the expected inflation in a currency and an expected real interest rate in a currency, I can come up with what I'll call a synthetic risk-free rate. I tried this actually on an Egyptian company last month because I was trying to get a risk-free rate in Egyptian pounds and I couldn't find a government bond rate. Basically, I couldn't find any of the avenues I would normally go about to get a risk-free rate. So I went to the World Bank and they had estimates of expected inflation by country, and for Egypt, the expected inflation they had was 15%. So I said, okay. I know the World Bank might be wrong, but at least I have a source for my wrong number now. I'll start with the 15%. Then I took the TIPS rate, the real risk-free rate, added it to the 15%, said, I'm done. I have a risk-free rate for you in Egyptian pounds. Adding expected inflation to a real interest rate will give you a risk-free rate. Here's another way you can use that inflation trick. Getting a risk-free rate in U.S. dollars is easy, right? Look up the T-bond rate. Let's say the risk-free rate in U.S. dollars is 2.5%. The inflation rate in the U.S. is 2%, and the inflation rate in Egypt is 15%. Here's all you need to do. Take the difference in inflation between the two currencies. It should be 15 minus 2, 13%. Add it to your T-bond rate, and you got a risk-free rate in a local currency. So start with the dollar risk-free rate, take the difference in inflation. In fact, I've given away a clue as to why risk-free rates vary across currencies. In fact, I've given away lots of clues. And here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to put all my risk-free rates at the start of 2017 on one page. And you can see they can go from negative numbers all the way to in Nigerian Naira. And I'm supposed to be in Nigeria at the end of next month if I don't come back. Remember this graph. So Nigerian. So basically, you can see the rates vary across currencies. Remember I said I'm going to give you a way to crack the currency code? I'm going to ask a question. If you can give me the answer to this question, you've nailed the currency code. Why do risk-free rates vary across currencies? Do risky countries have a higher risk-free rates? Repeat that question to yourself, because as you repeat the question, you're going to see how stupid it sounds, right? If they're really risk-free, who cares about the riskiness of the country, right? So it can't be risk. So what is it that causes differences across risk-free rates? I gave you the clue on the last page. What do we do to get a risk-free rate in the currency? We focused on inflation. High inflation currencies have high risk-free rates. Low inflation currencies have low risk-free rates. No inflation currencies can have really low risk-free rates. And deflationary currencies can have negative risk-free rates. That's it. Now do you see why currency doesn't matter in valuation? If I pick a high inflation currency, the bad news is your discount rates are going to be high. So if I pick Egyptian pounds to do your valuation in, you can have the 15% inflation feed into your discount rate. Your discount rate's going to be high. Tell me the good news. When I value the company in Egyptian pounds, my cash flows are going to be higher because that same inflation that hurt me in the discount rate is now going to help me on the cash flows. If I switch to a low inflation rate currency, the good news is my discount rate is going to be low. The bad news is you no longer have inflation carrying you on its shoulders and giving you higher growth. Do you see already what's going to get you into trouble? If you do your cash flows in a high inflation currency, let's say pesos or naira, and you discount it at a low inflation rate discount rate using US dollars, your valuations are going to blow up. Why? Because you fed in two different inflation rates into your numerator and denominator. It's amazing how in corporate finance and valuation people misunderstand currencies. I'll give you a classic example. I was talking to the CFO of an Indian company last week, and he kept saying, it's cheaper to borrow in dollars than in rupees. Is it? Technically, yes. It is cheaper to borrow because it's 8% in dollars, it's 12% in rupees. But comparing a dollar borrowing rate to a rupee borrowing rate does not make sense. Why? Because you have different currencies. I'll give you a much simpler analogy to bring this home. 2 weeks ago, I had to fly to India. So I flew out of New York. I checked my iPhone weather as I was getting on the plane. It's at 30 degrees. I landed 20 hours later, I guess, in Chennai. I checked my iPhone. It said 30 degrees. It didn't feel like it was the same temperature. What was the difference? When I left here and I checked, iPhones are really smart. Sometimes they're too smart for you. They sense where you are and they change the way they present the weather. So when I left, it was giving me the weather in Fahrenheit. When I landed, it was giving me the weather in Celsius. 30 degrees Fahrenheit and 30 degrees Celsius are two vastly different numbers. 30 degrees Celsius is 86 degrees Fahrenheit. Is that right? 30 times 1.8 plus 32, yeah. 86 degrees Fahrenheit. We don't say, we don't compare a Celsius temperature to a Fahrenheit temperature. Same reason, you can't compare a dollar rate to a rupee rate. So when you talk about currencies, remember inflation is always the big driver of currencies. And if you pick a currency, that's what's going to show up in your valuation. Any questions? So let's complete this process with that question I asked you. So as I said, January 1st, 2017, the USD bond rate was at 2.45%. So I'm going to play what's if, you know, what if, and you tell me whether you'd go along. So the T-bond rate is 2.45%. That's low by historic standards. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take the average T-bond rate over the last 30 years, let's say it's 5%, and replace my risk-free rate in my valuation with that average rate. Why? Because I think the rate's too low. You know what? I'm not. There are people actually, about 30% of all DCF valuations I've seen in the last decade have shifted to what they call normalized risk-free rates, which basically means they've replaced today's rate with some average over time. The alternative is just stick with the 2.45%. Should you normalize risk-free rates? Let's carry this to the next step. If I use a 5% risk-free rate, my normalized rate, what's going to happen to my discount rate in dollars? It's going to be higher, right? My discount rate goes up, what happens to my value? It's going to go down. It's going to probably drop below the stock price today. So basically, you're telling me not to buy the stock and do what instead? Put my money in something risk-free that'll earn 5%. Where am I going to find it? You just made this up. There is no normalized risk-free rate that I can invest in. A risk-free rate is an actual opportunity cost. We can bitch and we can moan about how low rates are today, but guess what? If we don't invest in stocks, that's where our money is going to be. It's going to be earning 2.45%. My advice to you is don't mess with risk-free rates. People feel the urge to do it. Replace a negative number with a positive number. Today's number with an average. Risk-free rates are actually what you can get in the market today if you don't invest in stock. And whether you and I like that number is irrelevant. So even though it might make you uncomfortable, stick with the risk-free rate as it prevails today. So to that answer of should I normalize rates, don't. It's just a recipe for disaster. You're asking for trouble. Just use the T-bond rate or the German bond rate or the Swiss franc rate, even if it's negative. And in fact, that's going to bring me to this issue of who's kept rates low. So every time I get on CNBC around this topic, of course, it always comes back to, hey, is the Fed keeping rates low? It's not even is the Fed keeping rates. It's presumed to be fact that it's central banks that have kept rates low. So I'll tell you a story that I told my corporate finance class last year, but I tell everybody about the Fed. You know that you can go on tours of the Fed? It's very exciting, actually. It's a building that looks like a jail. It looks like it's opposite 100 Maiden Lane, the old Chase building. So it's a building with all bars in the front. And 10 o'clock every day, they have this gathering in this. So you go into the building, they check your, you know, obviously your backpack has to go through the bomb detector and stuff. They gather a group of 25, and a guide takes you around the Federal Reserve building, showing you all the neat things. The neatest thing, of course, is big stacks of currency downstairs. So you'll actually see, you know, the bills stacked up. So about a year and a half ago, nothing to do. I decided to hang out with my family when they go visit the Fed. So basically, my wife and two of my younger kids, not that young. I don't know, one is 17, one is 14, 13. I forget their ages already. So this was a few years ago, 15 and 18 or something. They were dragged along. They really didn't want to go. Fed, not high on their... They said, could we have ice cream instead? It's after the Fed, maybe. So we show up. I almost made myself persona non grata at the start of the tour. Because here's what happened. A 23-year-old tour guide comes up, really nice young lady. And I almost asked her the question that would have made me persona non grata. And here's the question I plan to ask her. Could you take me to the interest rate room? You know the room I'm talking about? Where Janet Yellen comes in every day with all these levers. So I'm going to move the T-bond rate here, the T-bill rate here. Because that's the sense you get. The central bankers go in and they set rates. What's the only rate the Fed sets? Today when the Federal Open Market Committee says, we're going to raise rates, what's the only rate the Fed sets? The federal funds rate. That's the second question I was going to ask. What's the Fed funds rate? The rate at which banks can borrow short-term in the Fed window. So I said, can you show me the Fed window? I'd like to borrow some money at the Fed funds rate. It's not going to work. So the Fed funds rate, this incredibly narrow measure of interest rates, a really short-term rate which banks can, is the only rate that the Fed sets. They can't raise T-bond rates. They can't lower T-bond rates. Do they have some influence? Obviously, but they don't set those rates. So you're saying, but rates have been low for the last 10 years. How else can you explain it? Well, there you go. Remember I said interest rates are inflation plus real interest rates? So here's what I did. I went back until 1954, and each year I collected the inflation rate in the U.S. and the real GDP growth that year. And I added those two numbers up. So the inflation rate is 3% and real GDP growth is 2%. 3 plus 2 is 5%. I'm going to call that as an intrinsic risk-free rate. That's what the risk-free rate would be if the Fisher equation held. So see this red part? That red part is actually the inflation rate. The green is the GDP growth. And the blue is the actual T-bond rate. Now, you don't even have to bring out your statistics. Do you think the two tend to move together, the intrinsic risk-free rate? And why have rates been low for the last 10 years? Because inflation has been really low, and real growth has been abysmal. You add low plus abysmal, you get low and abysmal, which is what risk-free rates have been. The reason for risk-free rates being low for the last 10 years, it's not the Fed that's done it. It's the fact that the economy is not growing very fast, and there's not much inflation. So can the Federal Open Market Committee raise rates today? If rates go up, and they already have, right? Since November 8th, after the election, the T-bond rate is up almost 60 basis points, 0.6%. For better or worse, markets are reassessing expectations of inflation and real growth. That's what's going to drive what rates will do this year, not what the Federal Open Market Committee decides in that room. So don't get distracted by this talk of central banks raise rates, lower rates. It's so easy to look to that entity up there which is going to set rates. Rates ultimately come from below. They come from the economy, not from above, which is what I think of as central banks. Any questions? Which brings me to that final issue of negative risk-free rates. What are we going to do about them? Nothing. Take that Swiss franc rate, right? Minus 0.5%. Last year, I valued a Swiss company in Swiss francs. Oh, because I wanted to value, not because Swiss companies are incredibly boring companies to value. Why? Because the Swiss are really boring people. Now, I don't mean that as an insult, or maybe I do. But you're not going to see a lot of tech companies or growth companies, exciting companies. Swiss companies are nice, solid, money-making entities. They don't do anything exciting in either direction. So I decided to value a Swiss company in Swiss francs. So I start with the risk-free rate, which is minus 0.34% that day. So I put that as my risk-free rate, which brought down my cost of equity and cost of capital. Not surprisingly. That was the good news. But then when I proceeded to estimate the cash flows for this company, which happened to be a multinational, whose name rhymes with Pesley, I started projecting the cash flows out in another currency, and I had to convert them back into francs. And there, that low inflation, the deflation in the Swiss franc that helped me on the discount rate started to hurt me. So what happened was my cash flows then were growing at a really low rate in Swiss franc terms. I discounted them back at a really low discount rate. But I actually valued Nestle in both Swiss francs and US dollars, and I got the same value for the company. And the reason I did that was to illustrate that it doesn't really matter what currency I picked as long as I stayed consistent with that currency. So if you run into a negative risk-free rate, just go with the regular process for estimating discount rates. Just remember, when you do your cash flows, it's going to show up as a really low growth rate, perhaps even a negative growth rate when the company is mature, because that low inflation or deflation in the currency is going to show up in the cash flows as well. Any questions on risk-free rates? So, no. Yeah. Okay, the question is, will everything compounds? If I use a low risk-free rate, does it compound? It goes in my discount rate, then what happens to it? It compounds. High inflation rate, high discount rates. Everything in valuation compounds. So same thing with exchange rates. What's going to happen is, each year you're going to depreciate on top of the previous year. So when I project out my expected exchange rate in future years, if your inflation is 15% and minus 1%, your currency is going to depreciate roughly 14% a year, the high inflation currency, every year. And as you further out you go in time, the more deflated it's going to be. Okay. Any other questions on risk-free rates? Do you want to know how much time I spent on risk-free rates when I was taught valuation? It's a long, 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 long time ago. I think we spent 1.5 minutes on the risk-free rate. Here's what I was told. The U.S. Treasury rate is the risk-free rate. Let's move on. That didn't even last a minute and a half. Shows you how dollar-centric everything was. And second, the presumption was if it's the U.S. Treasury, of course it's risk-free. Those days are way behind us. We have to get comfortable working with different currencies, no matter where in the world you go to work. Because let's face it, even if you work in New York, the companies you work with have foreign exchange, foreign operations. You're going to have to deal with currency head on. You can't hide from it. And as long as you remember that inflation lesson, you're going to be okay. So now let's move on to equity risk premiums. So at this stage, we have that risk-free rate nailed down. Any other questions on the risk-free rate? Okay. Let's talk about equity risk premiums. The equity risk premium is the price for risk. In other words, the question I'm asking you when I ask you what is the equity risk premium is how much more than the risk-free rate would I need to offer you to invest in equities as a class? Let's make this real. Right now, the risk-free rate in U.S. dollars is about 2.5%, right? So the question I'm asking is, how much more than 2.5% would I need to offer you for you to put your money in U.S. stocks? That is the question that the equity risk premium is trying to answer. This is how most people in valuation try to answer the question. They look backwards. They say, over the last 50 years, the last 70 years, what would I have made investing in stocks as opposed to something risk-free? So let me get specific. If I go all the way back to 1928 and I invested in stocks instead of T-bonds, I would have earned about 4.62% more than my risk-free rate on a compounded base. And this is something I'm going to stay consistent with because everything is compounded than investing in T-bonds. So today's risk-free rate is 2.45%, and I trust this table. I should demand 4.62% more than 2.45%, which brings me to about, 7.06% or 7.07%. It's a risk-free rate plus that historical premium. The problem already you can see in that table. When I ask you, what is the historical risk premium for the U.S.? I could tell you it's 4.62%. I could also tell you it's 7.96% if I use the T-bill rate as my risk-free rate. Or I can tell you it's 2.3% if I go back only 10 years. Do you see why this is incredibly convenient for analysts? Because no matter what risk premium you use, you're probably going to be able to find it on the table, right? And remember we talked about bias? You're that owner trying to value a company. What kind of risk premium would you like to use if you're an owner valuing your own company? Your bias is to push the value up, right? And if you want to push the value up, you want a low risk premium or a high risk premium? You want a low risk premium, so you go to this table and you tell me, you know what, the historical risk premium is 2.3%. And there will be an expert witness you can sign up who would say, that's true. Technically, that is a historical risk premium. Whereas if your bias is the venture capital bias, you want to convince me your company is not worth very much, guess what? I'm going to go to the 7.96%. So that's a historical risk premium. And that's the first problem with historical risk premiums, like trying to nail Jell-O to a wall. It's a shifting number depending on what slice you look at, whether you define it as T-bills or T-bonds, whether you look at arithmetic or geometric averages. Second, I think we forget our basic statistics when we start using these numbers, right? Because in statistics, when I give you a lot of data and you compute an average, what are you trained to put in brackets below that number to tell the world how uncertain you are about your own numbers? The standard error. Remember that in Stat 101? The standard error. See these numbers right below? Those are my standard error. When I tell you the risk premium for the last 80-something years is 4.62%, that sounds incredibly precise until I tell you, oh, by the way, the standard error in that number is 2.28%. Think about it. If your premium is 4.62 and the standard error is 2.28%, the true premium can be close to zero or more than 9%. That's with 80-something years of data. With 10 years of data, when I tell you the risk premium is 2.3%, I might as well have told you absolutely nothing because the standard error in that number is 8. This is pure noise. So the next time you see a Chinese analyst value a Chinese company and use a historical risk premium for China, just pick up the valuation, throw it in the trash can, don't even look at it. Because you don't have 85 years of historical premium for China. You have, 15, maybe 20 years. And that number is pure noise given how volatile stock returns are. And there's a third assumption you make whenever you use historical risk premium. Even if you trust this number and you use it, what are you telling me about the future? When you use a historical risk premium for the U.S., the 4.62%, and you use that as your premium going forward, what are you telling me about the future? that the future is going to look like the past. That there's mean reversion. And mean reversion is not a bad assumption if you're in a stable system, right? And for 100 years in the U.S., we were able to draw on the fact that the U.S. was a stable system. Things kind of reverted back to the mean. To me, 2008 was a breaking point. Because it wasn't just the crisis. It changed the nature of the global economy. I don't think the next 100 years are going to look like the last 100 years. So even if I trust these numbers, it's incredibly dangerous of me to use these numbers as my expected premiums for the future. Because I think there's been a structural break in the system. That's what the crisis did. So long story short, I don't do valuations using history. I report this every year. At the start of the every year, I do it on my website. I report the historical premium. I never use it. I never use it because I know what the past looks like. It's useful to know what the past looks like. I don't think this is a good estimate of a forward-looking premium. Of course, I haven't told you what I fill it in with, but for the moment, I'm just telling you why I hold back on this premium. In fact, that's part of the issue with historical premiums is that standard error is such an immense number, especially with short time periods, 20, 30, 40 years. And there is also a hint of a survivorship bias. And here's why. What's a market I looked at in the previous page? The U.S. market, right? What was the most successful market of the 20th century? The U.S. market. I've picked the most successful equity market of the 20th century. I'm backing out of it the premium I would have earned. And then what am I doing? I'm extrapolating it as the premium I'm going to earn for the next 100 years. When I have no idea what the best market for the next 100 years is. There are all kinds of reasons for abandoning historical premiums. But having said that, 85% of you are going to end up working in places where the historical risk premium is the premium that's used in valuation. Don't do anything stupid. You're a low person on the totem pole. Just mutter to yourself. Do what you're asked to do. But once you get to a position where you can make change, push for change. It doesn't make any sense because historical premiums no longer have the resonance that they did maybe 20 or 30 years ago. In fact, to show you how risk premiums vary across markets, there is this extraordinary database that's been accumulated at the London Business School. And that it's maintained by the two professors, Dimson and Marsh, and it's published by CSFB. Where rather than just reporting the historical premium for the U.S., they reported across multiple markets going back to 1900. The premium across the globe over the last 115 years for stocks over something risk-free is not the 4.62% that you see for the U.S. It's closer to 3.2%. So look at the bottom. It's an average across. So there are good markets and bad markets. Some markets you earn more, some markets you earn less. But this is the way I think about investing in the next 100 years. I don't know which market to put my money in. If I did, I'd load up on that market. I have no idea what the winner market is going to be for the next 100 years. That's the challenge we face with equities, and our risk premiums have to start reflecting it. Any questions on historical risk premiums? Now let's talk about what to do about countries where you don't have. So even if you decide historical data is your only way to go, I already said if you have only 20 or 25 years of data, you're not going to be able to compute a historical risk premium that you can use. So I'm going to go through three different ways in which I estimate equity risk premiums for individual countries. And I'll stick with Brazil. Why? Because we started in Brazil. We've used Brazil so far. Might as well use it one extra step. So let's say you ask me to estimate an equity risk premium for Brazil. Historical data is out of the question. There isn't enough reliable historical data in Brazil to do what I did in the U.S., even if I wanted to. So here's the first way I can think about estimating equity risk premiums. And this is the way most investment banks do it right now. They start with a base premium that they get for the U.S., maybe by looking at the historical data. I'm going to start with a base premium for the U.S. of 5.69%. You're saying, where did that come from? In a little while, I'll fill in that detail, perhaps in the next session. But that's my base premium for January 2017 for the U.S., 5.69%. So that's a premium I'm demanding for investing in the U.S. equity market. So here's my first question to you. Is the Brazilian equity market riskier or safer than the U.S. market? It's riskier. So if I can give you a measure of how much riskier Brazil is, then I can add it on to the 5.69%. You can come up with a risk premium for Brazil. Just at the start of today's class, I took Brazil and I tried to come up with a risk-free rate in reais, right? And what did I look up? I looked up a default spread for Brazil. I know this is cheating, but remember that 3.45% default spread I came up with based on the rating? I'm going to use that as my measure of additional risk premium for Brazil. It's reaching because I'm using a measure of default risk as my measure of additional risk. You add the 3.47% to the 5.69%, my risk premium for Brazil will be 9.16%. Now do you see why I asked you not to spend too much time deciding what default spread to use? So if you had decided to go with a CDS spread of 3.21%, you'd have subtracted 3.21% to come up with your risk-free rate, which would have given you a higher risk-free rate. But when you got to this stage, you'd be adding the 3.21%, which would give you a lower risk premium. It takes care of itself. So this is the first approach. You add the default spread onto the U.S. premium. You come up with the premium for the country. And if you have a country with zero default risk, then your premium for that country will be the same premium that you charge for the U.S., 5.69%. There's a second approach that is called the Goldman approach. Basically, Goldman Sachs came up with this about 20 years ago. And here's what they did. They also start with the U.S. premium, 5.69%. Then they look up two numbers. One is the standard deviation in the Bovespa, which is the Brazilian equity index. The second is the standard deviation in the S&P 500, which is U.S. equities. So hang in there with me. The standard deviation they got for the Bovespa was 30%. Standard deviation for the S&P is 18%. Let's set up an algebra problem. You invest in the U.S. equity market with a standard deviation of 18%. You're demanding a 5.69% risk premium, right? I come to you with the Brazilian market with a standard deviation of 30%, much higher than the 18%. I would expect you to take the 5.69% and scale it up for the additional risk. I'm using algebra to scale up the risk. I come up with a risk premium for Brazil of 9.48%. I'm basically creating an additional risk premium for Brazil. Instead of 3.47%, I'm using a risk premium of 3.79%. This is actually an approach that's very intuitive. It makes sense because if you look at the standard deviations, the relative measure of risk, it's also an approach that can lead you into some very strange places. I'll give you an example. Last year, I was in Buenos Aires towards the end of the year, and of course, the market's opening up, the country's starting to get more capital in. And I gave a talk at the stock exchange in Buenos Aires. So it's middle of the day, trading day. I give a talk, and then they said, do you want to look at the exchange floor? So they lead me to this big glass window, and there are two guys sitting at their desks watching Wimbledon tennis. It's summer, U.S. Open tennis, something. I don't even remember who was playing. And I look at the floor, and there's nobody on the floor. And I said, what's going on? Where is everybody? And they said, well, there's not much trading going on. I think, so what? If you have a market where there's very little trading, very little liquidity, what kind of standard deviation are you going to see in that market? What standard deviation measure on based on changes in prices? For prices to change, you need trading. As trading drops off, the standard deviation becomes... You're saying, so what? Let's say I told you the standard deviation for the Argentine market is 6%. There's no trading. That could happen. Using this approach, what are you going to end up with as your risk premium for Argentina? You're going to take the U.S. risk premium of 5.47%, and you're going to multiply by 6 over 18. In other words, you're going to give Argentina this really small equity risk premium. And that makes no sense to me. So this approach works if you have liquid markets. It starts to fall apart when you don't. So I'll give you my third approach, and this is the approach that I've used for the last 20 years to come up with country risk premiums. I start with the U.S. premium, 5.69%, just like I did the first approach. I look up the default spread of 3.47%, just like I did in the first approach, but now I look up two numbers within that same country. One is the standard deviation of the Bovespa, which is 30%. The second is the standard deviation in the Brazilian government bond, which is 20%. Do you see where I'm going? If the default spread is in the Brazilian government bond and I can get the risk of that bond, my argument is if equity is 1.5 times more risky than the bond, my default spread has to be scaled up by 1.5. The additional risk premium I have for Brazil then is 5.21%. You add that on to the 5.69%, you come up with a total risk premium for Brazil of 10.9%. So the first approach, you just add the default spread. The second approach, you scale up based on relative standard deviations in the two equity markets. The third approach, you start with the default spread, but you scale up that default spread for how much risk your equity is in that market relative to the government bond. I can't prove that this is the best approach. It's the approach I find myself using because I'm comfortable with it. And at the start of every year, and actually twice every year, I use this approach to come up with risk premiums for countries. So I'll take you through what my January 2017 numbers look like. I started with a base premium of 5.69%. As I said, I'll come back and fill in that detail of where that number came from, but that's my risk premium for the US. Second stop, I went and got sovereign local currency ratings for every country that Moody's rates. It's 140 countries. If a country is not rated, then I find what's called a country risk score. It's actually, you know, it's a, or if I can find an S&P rating, I convert to a Moody's rating. So second stop, I now have a rating for about 145 countries. Third stop, I use a table that I just showed you to get the rating, the default spread based on the rating, the one that I use in approach three for Brazil, and I look up the default spread for each country. So now I have 5.69% US premium default spread for the 145 countries that are rated. If your country is AAA rated, my life just got very simple because the default spread for a AAA rated country is zero. And if it's zero, I can just use the US risk premium. So you'll see 5.69% as a risk premium for Germany, for Switzerland, for Australia. All AAA rated countries will end up with a 5.69%. If you're not AAA rated, I start with the default spread. And then I tried to do what I did for Brazil, which is look up the standard deviation for the equity index and the government bond. And one of the problems with that is most countries don't have traded government bonds. It's very difficult to look up the standard deviation. So I cheat. I look up the standard deviation in an emerging market equity index. The S&P has an index of emerging market equities. And I look up the standard deviation in an emerging market government bond index. So rather than look for individual, I look up this broad portfolio. That ratio at the start of 2017 was 1.23. Equities are about 1.23 times more risky than bonds. I'm almost home. I take the risk-free rate. I take the default spread times 1.23. I have an equity risk premium for a country. That gives me equity risk premiums for 146 countries. But there are 20 countries that are stubbornly off my list. These are called frontier markets. Know what they share in common? They're incredibly risky, and nobody wants to rate them because they're scared. Like what? Syria. Afghanistan. If you said you're going to invest in these countries, so what kind of risk premium should I use? I'd say a really big premium, but then if you say, what's the specific number? Until 2 years ago, I said, I don't know, because I really don't have a rating for you, and that's really not fair. In fact, part of what triggered my decision to bring these 20 into the fold was I got an email from a Syrian business person. There's actually one guy left in Syria running a business, I guess. And he said, look, you know, I've been looking on your table for the risk premium I should be using, and I can't find Syria. And I said, it's because you're not rated. He said, what do I do? And I said, you know what, I should fill in the gap. So starting about 2 years ago, here's what I started to do. For those countries for which I cannot find a rating, I go to this service in Europe called Political Risk Services. And what they give you is a country risk score for a country. So it's this composite score. For Syria, so it goes from high to low. High are your safe countries, low are your risky countries. And they give scores for 160 countries, including Syria and Afghanistan. So I looked up the score for Syria. It's like 43, really low. Guess what I did next? I went looking for other countries which had similar scores that had a rating. I'm stretching here, but can I hang in there with me? So let's say I found three other countries, like Lebanon, with similar country risk scores. I have a rating and a risk premium for them. I attach the risk premium for those countries to Syria. See, that is really reaching. If you can find a better way to do it, just let me know. I'll be glad to come along. The moment, that's the only way I can get risk premiums, and this is what the world looks like to me at the start of 2017. So let's start with the easy numbers. US Canada, 5.69%. I start with the U.S., a 5.69%. As I said, I'll fill in that detail. Every AAA-rated country in the world, you'll see 5.69%. So U.S., Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Germany, Netherlands, all 5.69%. If you're not AAA-rated, then I have a default spread and an additional premium so that, you know. So let's take a look at Latin America. If you look across Latin America, the safest country in Latin America to invest in is Chile. And the riskiest country, and this is no surprise, is Venezuela. Why? Because it has an awful rating. At the very top are my frontier markets. If you're saying I can't find my country, well, if you are interested in investing in North Korea, just don't do anything rash. There it is. Okay. So you want to start a company, half your business will be in Liberia, half in North Korea. Good luck to you. There are the numbers. Go out and do something with them. But this is the world as I see it in terms of equity risk premiums. You're saying, how many North Korean companies am I going to value? Why do I need all these risk premiums if all I'm going to be valuing are U.S. and European companies? Why do we need all these risk premiums? When I value Coca-Cola, do I need this? Why? It's a U.S. company, but it gets its revenues from all over the world. I need this entire picture in front of me with almost every company I value. You think Vale is a Brazilian company? Dream on. You know what Vale's biggest market is? China. Here's an answer. Anytime you don't know the answer to a question, try it, China. It's amazing how often that works out to be the answer, right? What's the reason we're in a global crisis? China. Why are interest rates going up? China. There's like 6 degrees of separation from China, no matter what the problem is or what the question is. China. So to value Vale, what do I need to know? I need to know the Chinese risk premium. I have to value Royal Dutch. And you're going to see this. You know how many countries I have to go looking for risk premiums for? Why? Where's the oil in the world? In the most dangerous parts. It's almost like God says, hey, you know what? I'm going to give you trouble, so you have some oil. And if you look at the picture of where Royal Dutch gets its oil, guess what? It's exposed to incredible amounts of country risk. So this becomes the basis for my thinking about what to do next. So that table is the table that you're going to see me draw on as I value individual companies. So now let's complete the process. I have risk premiums for countries. Incidentally, as you look at this table, just remember that there is no intellectual firepower behind these numbers. It's basically, it's a transparent process based on default spreads. So it is what it is, right? So now let's talk about what to do with this risk premium. There are three approaches you can use. The first is what I call the bludgeon approach. It's an approach I don't like. Well, what analysts do is they take every company in a country and they give it that country risk premium. So if you're an Indian company, all Indian companies get the Indian country risk premium. If you're a U.S. company, all U.S. companies get the U.S. risk premium. I don't like that because that presumes that if you're a U.S. company, your risk exposure comes locally. The second is to adjust the risk premium and bring it into your calculation by multiplying by beta. So you're saying, if you're a high-risk company, I'm going to give you a higher exposure to country risk. And the third is, somehow my Greek symbols got knocked out, is to actually come up with an extra factor where you capture country risk premium separately and measure exposure to it differently. So I'm at least going to start on that process because I want to talk about once you get the country risk premium, what do you do with it? Let's start with the first of those questions. The first is, how do I come up with a country risk premium for a company? The first is very lazy. You look at where you're incorporated and you attach a risk premium based on where you're incorporated. So U.S. Coca-Cola, U.S. company, U.S. risk premium. Tata Consulting Services, Indian company, Indian risk premium. Very country incorporated. The second is to look at where you do business. So I'm going to take two companies so you can see how this plays out. The first is a company called Embraer. For those of you not familiar, it's a Brazilian aerospace company. And the first analysis I did was in 2004. That's the first time I valued Embraer. So I had no idea what Embraer did. I knew it was a Brazilian company. I was, you know, just going along with my valuation using a Brazilian risk premium. And I took a look at where they got their revenues. And here's what I saw in 2004. They got 3% of their revenues in Brazil and 97% of their revenues in the U.S. and Western Europe. And I said, this isn't fair. Why should I be attaching a Brazilian country risk premium to a company that gets almost all of its revenues outside? In fact, if I compare the pie chart for where Embraer gets its revenues to the pie chart for where Boeing gets its revenues, I couldn't tell them apart. So what I did was I took a weighted average, 97% of a mature market premium, so that time was 5%, and 3% times the Brazilian risk premium, so that time was 12.89%. The risk premium I gave Embraer was very close to the risk premium that I gave Boeing, and I think that's the fairest thing to do. In fact, I took Ambev, which is a Brazilian-based beverage company, in 2011, and Ambev actually has increasingly become a Latin American beverage company. So when I valued Ambev in 2011, I looked at where they got their revenues, and you can see it's spread out across Latin America. Brazil is still their biggest market, 64%. But you can see that they get big chunks of revenues from the other countries. My risk premium is a weighted average of those country risk premiums weighted by revenues. Why am I weighting by revenues? Because it's often the only number that they break down by country. I mean, it's true some companies might give you EBITDA by region, but most companies, the only number you will see broken down by region or by country is going to be revenues. Can that get me into trouble? Absolutely. But the revenue breakdown is there. I just took the weighted average based on revenues. Incidentally, I did this for Coca-Cola, and you can see what I meant about why, if you're just doing U.S. companies, you can't evade this issue. Coca-Cola is a U.S. company. We looked at the breakdown of revenues. It gets only 40% of its revenues in North America, that U.S. and Canada. Okay? And you can see it's spread out over the rest of the world. Why am I not breaking it down by individual country? That table will have 72 countries in it. And second, Coca-Cola actually doesn't break down its revenues by country. It just breaks them down by region. In fact, that's one reason. If you go back to the picture that I showed you, you'll notice there's a regional average. Those are weighted averages. What do I mean by that? To compute the risk premium, the weighted premium for Asia, I took the equity risk premiums for all of the Asian countries, but then I weighted by their GDPs. I want China to be weighted a lot more in Asia than Vietnam because it's a much bigger economy. So the regional averages is what I used to come up with Coca-Cola's risk premium. So even though it's a U.S. company, which in 2012 would have given it a 6% risk premium, because of its exposure to other markets, I come up with a 7.14% premium. Okay. That revenue focus is going to get us into trouble because let's face it, revenues are not the only reason you have country risk. Your manufacturing operations are in a country and the country goes to hell in a handbasket. By focusing just on revenues, you're going to miss it. Okay. And this was especially the case when I valued Royal Dutch. Because when I first valued Royal Dutch, I did what I usually do, look at where the revenues are. And with oil companies, since they sell into a global oil market, it really doesn't look like it's that risky. So with Royal Dutch, I decided that revenues were not where the risk came from, that they came from where the reserves for the company came from, which they break down. And this is where Royal Dutch's reserves look like. So put right off the annual report, that's their breakdown, and you can see big chunks from, you have Nigeria, you have Oman, you have Malaysia. Basically, it's a who's who of emerging market risk, and you see the weights. The risk premium that I used to value Royal Dutch, and this is like March or April of last year, was 8.26%, significantly higher than the risk premium I would have for just the U.S. If I did this for ExxonMobil, you know the biggest portion of their revenues are where they are? It's Russia. So basically, Russia is a big chunk of their country risk exposure because of how much of their reserves are in Russia. So that's what you're trying to bring in, is you're not getting fooled by where a company's incorporated. You're looking past the incorporation at where they do business. Okay. Any questions on this weighting process? No. Why is this such silence? Is it so intimidating, these numbers? One final point, and we'll end for the day. In some companies, I actually tried to estimate exposure to country risk separately. And I'll tell you the genesis for this particular approach, and we'll end for the day. When I talked about Embraer in 2004, it was actually for a valuation seminar I was doing in Brazil, and I'd actually valued Embraer using the traditional, it's a Brazilian company, give it the Brazilian risk premium. And of course, it was on the flight to Brazil. It's a long flight. It's like 10 hours. I was next to somebody who was kind of oozing into my seat, and so I couldn't go to sleep. So I pulled up my presentation. I started going through it. And I got to this point, recognizing that 97% of their revenues came from outside Brazil. And I said, hey, you know what? I can't be attaching the Brazilian country risk group. So I concocted a measure that I call lambda. You know how beta measures your exposure to risk? It's scaled around 1. Lambda measures your exposure to country risk, scaled around 1. Why lambda? Because I've discovered attaching a Greek alphabet to anything gives it this layer of sophistication that makes people a little nervous. So let's call it lambda. L, people would not be intimidated. Lambda sounds so much fancier. So I end up in Sao Paulo. I teach all day. And somewhere during the course of the day, I throw this idea out. You know what? Wouldn't it be nice if we could estimate a lambda for Embraer that captured how exposed it was to Brazilian country risk? They all kind of agreed. And then one of the people in the front row, pain in the neck all through the day, puts up his hand and says, that's nice, but how do you plan to measure this lambda? I said, I don't know, but I have a long trip back to the U.S., and I'll think of something along the way. In fact, if you go to my website, there's a paper on measuring lambdas that came right out of that long flight. Essentially, I look for things that I would focus on to decide how exposed a company was to country risk, and I'll come up with a list of some of the things that I would focus on. One is obviously where you get your revenues. The second is where your factories and operations are. The third is, and this is kind of a subtle thing, whether you're viewed as a company in the national interest. You know what happens when you're classified as a company in the national interest? The government interferes constantly in what you do. Which means that if there's country risk, it gets magnified. I know I'll send you a link to a post I did on Petrobras about 2 years ago, on how you take a $100 billion company and make it a $10 billion company. This is not a strategy I would suggest in most companies, but one of the big reasons was constant government interference at every level of the company. So I listed all the things I would need to get a lambda, and I tried to come up with a way of measuring lambda. So when we start on Monday, I will take you through some of those approaches, but I want you to go back and review what we did about historical risk premiums and country risk premiums, because on Monday when we start, we're going to come up with how we came up with that 5.69% for the U.S.